This is the son of PCJ.
Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. I'm Keith Parron. In this edition, South Korea and Japan are getting closer to signing a military agreement. Japan could spark a new leadership row in the country if a new tax bill is passed. Burma becoming the world's largest opium producer. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. South Korea is expected to sign a military agreement with Japan in what will be the first such pact since Japanese colonial rule ended in 1945. The Yonhap News Agency in Seoul, citing a foreign ministry source, says the agreement will include intelligence sharing about North Korea and its nuclear ambitions. The relationship between South Korea and Japan has often been clouded by suspicion. But North Asia watchers say problematic considerations have brought the two nations a little closer. Sen Lam speaks with Professor John McKay, founding partner of Analysts International, a research group based in Melbourne, Australia.
Well, South Korea already has such agreements with a number of other countries, including Australia, to share intelligence and to provide aid of various kinds in the event of some kind of emergency in the region. So in that sense, this notion of an agreement with Japan is not particularly unusual. However, given the long-standing historical tensions with Japan, there is some debate about what exactly this agreement might involve. Earlier it was suggested that as well as sharing intelligence from aircraft sources, from satellites, and from a variety of other sources, that there might be a clause in the agreement to allow Japanese troops to enter South Korea in the event of some kind of emergency. Now, I think this has been recognized by the South Korean government as a bridge rather too far for public opinion in South Korea. And as far as we understand it, that clause has been dropped from the agreement, which is likely to be signed in the next few days. So the agreement is not so much for logistics and the kinds of things that were to be included in the agreement, but for the sharing of intelligence in the narrow sense. South Korea recognizes that Japan has some superior technology in a number of areas, particularly in spy satellites and in more sophisticated kinds of surveillance aircraft. And the South Koreans know very well that Japan has a lot of information on North Korea and is constantly monitoring the North Korean regime and its activities, and is keen to have access to that kind of information.
As you pointed out, historically, Japan and South Korea have always had a slightly suspicious relationship. Do you think pragmatic considerations, such as an increasingly adventurous North Korea and indeed a stronger China, that have brought the two nations closer?
I think without a doubt. There's always the potential for derailing this kind of agreement between Japan and South Korea. There is the long-standing legacy of the Japanese colonial rule in South Korea, which lasted until 1945. But since then, there have been a whole series of other causes of tension. Tokyo's unwillingness to apologize for and to compensate the comfort women from the Second World War. Debates over some disputed small islands in what Korea calls the East Sea and what Japan calls the Sea of Japan. All of those kinds of tensions have added to the historical tension left over from the Second World War. But as you say, North Korea has become increasingly adventurous and increasingly perhaps sophisticated in its weaponry. And I think the attempted launch, even though it wasn't successful, of a space vehicle earlier this year by the North Koreans has really pushed South Korea into trying to get much better information on what's happening in North Korea. And there, of course, have been in the last few weeks suggestions that North Korea is perhaps preparing to have yet another nuclear test.
Might we read this impending accord as a sign of trust or growing trust between Japan and South Korea? And indeed, do you think such accords are a useful development in terms of regional security?
I think they are useful. I think South Korea is somewhat wary of Japan and always will be. I don't think there's, in our lifetimes, there's not going to be any great warmth, I think, in that relationship. Also, South Korea is worried that China may interpret a growing relationship between Japan and South Korea as some kind of ganging up on China, and I think the South Koreans would be wary of giving that impression. Both Japan and South Korea are, of course, economically enmeshed in very important ways with the Chinese economy, but they also want to make sure that China, South Korea particularly wants to make sure that China does not see South Korea as forming some kind of alliance against China. So I don't think the relationship between South Korea and Japan is ever going to be particularly warm, but it is useful. And if it's played correctly, I think the Chinese will not react too much, although I'm sure that South Korea will be sending appropriate messages to Beijing in that regard.
That was Professor John McKay, founding partner of Analysts International Research Group, based in Melbourne, Australia. A controversial bill which could jeopardize Japan's leadership has passed the lower house of parliament. The bill to double sales tax has been the top of the agenda of Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda from the start of his term last year. The bill passed with a comfortable majority of 57 members of Mr. Noda's own party failed to support it. If 54 of them defect to the Democratic Party, it could raise the prospect of early elections before it's due in 2013. Karen Snowden has the story.
For years, it's been a political battleground, but now there's agreement to double Japan's consumption tax from 5 to 10% over 3 years. As most countries have some form of value-added tax of 10% or more, in Europe it can be over 20%, most would think it's not such a big deal. But with a potential mutiny within his own party, headed by the powerful deal-maker Ichiro Ozawa, the stakes are high for the Prime Minister. Professor Jeff Kingston, Director of Asian Studies at Temple University in Tokyo, says if the group of dissenters leaves or is thrown out of the Democratic Party, the Noda government will face a crisis.
They're already on the ropes, and public opinion polls show that if elections are held soon, they won't do very well. So this is a situation where the opposition LDP is rubbing its hands and enjoying the show.
Ahead of the vote, Prime Minister Noda had urged his party to support the bill. There is no reprieve for this, he said. We cannot wait. This comprehensive reform is symbolic of the type of politics that cannot be postponed. I ask for your support from the very bottom of my heart, says Prime Minister Noda. Mr. Noda thought the potential rift within his party to get the bill through was a price worth paying. The hope is to raise more taxes to help pay for Japan's growing social security costs and bring down the government's huge debt. That debt is double the size of the entire GDP of Japan, the world's third biggest economy. The bill seems certain to also pass the upper house with the support of opposition parties. Hiromichi Shirakawa, chief economist with Credit Suisse, says, however, the deficit will continue to grow.
Tax hikes in the future is unlikely to get the Japanese fiscal situation back on track, and we tend to think that by 2020, Japanese government deficit will be even bigger than current level.
So, in your opinion, this is a whole lot of pain for very little gain, the tax itself?
Well, I think the main problem for the Japanese economy is, of course, declining trend growth. And in particular, in money terms, in nominal terms, Japanese GDP is now shrinking on average basis about 1% per annum. That means tax base is likely to continue to shrink. So I think that trend decline of GDP is unlikely to stop, and the planned tax hikes would even accelerate the pace of that shrinkage.
Yet Prime Minister Noda has put his leadership on the line in pushing hard for this bill, hasn't he?
Yes, I think the Japanese authorities now believe that they have to do something to get more confidence from the market in the midst of the European debt crisis.
Japan is in a vicious cycle. An ageing population, rising pension costs, and a contracting economy the government doesn't seem to have the answers for. And with the tax increase, consumers might retreat further. Jeff Kingston.
But it's a regressive tax. And the problem facing the government is regressive tax not only hit lower income groups harder, but they also hit those people, retirees, living on fixed income. And so given Japan's aging problem and the fact that the big baby boom generation is now retiring, this could come back to haunt the ruling party at the polls.
And what about the economic future? Hiromichi Shirakawa doesn't like the word depression, but he's not optimistic.
Yeah, I think depression is not necessarily a good word in my sense, but I think Japan's economy is, you know, contracting continuously.
We now go to Burma, where last year it had ambitious distinction of being the world's second largest opium supplier after Afghanistan. Now, Chinese authorities say the poppy growing area of Burma's north has increased 41% each year. Those figures are backed up by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, which is just about to release its... annual World Drug Report. Laura Tashinagati speaks with Gary Lewis, the UN representative for East Asia and the Pacific on Drugs and Crime.
What I can tell you is that we've got, our surveys have been conducted in Myanmar for about a decade, and what I can say is that from a local base of about 20,000 hectares in 2006, the cultivation has doubled over the last 5 years. In the preceding year, i.e. the year ending in 2011, for which we have stats, the increase on the year before that was 16%.
How concerning is that?
Well, we're very concerned, obviously. More means more. And if you have more drugs available, that means that there's a market for it, and all of the ancillary problems continue. And what we are really concerned about is the availability not only of opiates, but of methamphetamine. But fixing our gaze on opium, I mean, there are a number of things that are required to be done to fix that problem, and I think we can do it, especially in the new circumstances, with a government that is very keen to take action on drugs in Myanmar.
So have you spoken with the government at all about this? What sort of action are they indicating they will take?
I think that we are pretty well engaged with the government. Certainly the United Nations is, and UNODC is in our particular area of Shan State, which is where most of the, over 9/10 of the poppy in Myanmar is produced in Shan. We are the only agency on the ground there, along with World Food Programme, providing alternatives. And those are that's the carrot required in tandem with what the government is doing, which is a fairly severe form of eradication. By our count, the government is effectively eradicating well over a quarter of what was just produced last season. And you compare that with Afghanistan, which only eradicated 3% of the crop. We see that as a signal that things can happen. But eradication alone is not the solution, as I've been saying.
And you also mentioned that there's an increase in methamphetamine production as well. How surprising is that in Burma?
Well, the way you frame your question, how surprising is that? I mean, I'd be more interested to look at the fact that it is happening and look at how we can try as a community in the region and as an international community to counteract that through a more effective border control, through more effective cooperation along the Mekong River, and through more effective prevention programs in the main markets for meth, which are Thailand and China.
Well, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime is about to release its annual World Drug Report, Gary Lewis. The contents won't be publicly released for another few hours, but can you speak at all about what the report's main findings will be for the Asia-Pacific region?
what we say on the Asia-Pacific region has actually been in the public domain for 3 or 4 months, certainly on amphetamines and on opium when we released our survey sometime last year. So the good thing about the report is that it pulls together a number of threads and strands from across the planet and gives the reader, I think, a reasonably clear snapshot of where we stand on the drugs issue globally. And the big picture is that, according to our numbers and our assessment, containment, the approach to containing the world's drug problem through a combination of conventions, laws, and public consensus behind such conventions is working.
You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. China is in the grip of a renewed debate on its controversial one-child policy. Earlier this year, a woman in northern Shanxi province was 7 months pregnant at the time and was forced to undergo an abortion when she couldn't afford to pay the $6,000 fine, exceeding China's strict one-child policy. When a photograph of the beridden mother and the bloody fetus was posted on the internet, it caused an outcry and then a backlash, with local officials leading a march to denounce the family members as traitors, and reports that the woman's husband was beaten and has now disappeared. China has flirted with relaxing the policy in recent years, which has caused a gender imbalance, a ballooning percentage of elderly people, and a dwindling labor force. But it has so far resisted any change. Wayne Shield speaks to Wang Feng, the director of Booking Xinhua Center for Public Policy in Beijing.
Oh, I think this shows that the Chinese public has begun to seriously question the legitimacy of the one-child policy. And this is not the first time, hopefully the last time, such atrocity was committed. But in the past, such events were forgiven because the one-child policy was deemed or perceived to be good for the country. And this is no longer the case in the eyes of the public.
This is probably a difficult question to answer, but I'd appreciate it if you'd have a go at it. How much larger would China's population be now if it hadn't had this policy in place?
Various scholars have done work, including myself and Professor Tai Yong at the University of North Carolina in the United States. Had there not been the one-child policy, the current size of China's population would not be more than 100 million larger than what it is now. What we've seen in China in the last 20 years, when its fertility level dropped to below the replacement level, it's not different from what we've seen in other societies, especially in Asia.
So there'd be 100 million more people living in China?
That we could have that, but it's a number that we cannot answer, given that we don't have a counterfactual.
Yeah.
So it's the best study people could compare to look at Thailand, look at South Korea, look at Indonesia, where in the absence of the one-child policy, how fertility has dropped to a very similar level, for instance, in Thailand.
Hypothetically, would such a large population increase be, or would it have been sustainable? We're talking about 100 million more people. How sustainable would that be in China?
Would certainly be sustainable. There is this misconception that the population is just simply a matter of numbers. And I think in the long run, Chinese families and Chinese society would be a lot better served if more families have two children instead of what they have now, which is one child. And as you mentioned earlier, with the population aging, with the declining labor supply, but especially with the weakening family system, and these combined will pose tremendous challenge for Chinese families and individuals in the future. So had China had additional 100 million people spreading over its families, it's not going to create a problem, and fertility will stabilize and population will eventually stabilize and decline, as we've seen elsewhere in the world.
What are some of the other consequences of the policy in terms of the labor force and gender balance?
I think the most neglected aspect of the consequences is really its impact on each Chinese family, Chinese individuals. We're looking at 70% of urban families with only one child and 40% nationwide with only one child families. And the well-being of these only children and the well-being of their parents when they grow older, this is something we cannot measure in terms of dollar signs.
The blind lawyer Chen Guangcheng has just been allowed to move to the United States after seeking refuge in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. He'd exposed thousands of forced abortions and sterilizations, but for this he suffered years of abuse and house arrest. Why do you think there is so much intimidation for the opponents of the one-child policy?
Well, I think the root cause is really the insistence on the continuation of this one-child on the policy. Scholars and the public have been calling for the ending of the policy, phasing out the policy for 10 years, but the government has insisted in a way it's inaction. And that just caused more and more outrage and frustration. People cannot understand why such a policy is still needed.
If you would like to contact us here at Focus Asia Pacific to let us know what you think of the program, just send us an email. Our email address is very simple, pcj@pcjmedia.com. That's pcj@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. And finally, Indian health authorities have refuted claims that an untreatable strain of tuberculosis is triggering a major health crisis. Before World War II, tuberculosis killed two-thirds of those who contracted it. Today, India is home of one-fifth of the world's tuberculosis patients, but it is also home of an extensive program to treat TB. And whether or not a crisis is looming, recent claims of a TB superbug resistant to all available medication, this is rising concerns among some health professionals. Annabel Boyer has the story.
One of India's leading authorities on tuberculosis, Dr. Sudhir Udwadia, has reported the emergence of an untreatable strain of TB among his patients at a hospital in Mumbai. He says the number of patients with the superbug strain has increased. So is India ready to deal with the challenge? Dr. Ashok Kumar is the head of India's tuberculosis control program in New Delhi, and he says there's no cause for alarm.
There is nothing called total drug resistance.
Aren't the claims being made that there is total drug resistance? So do you refute those claims?
No, there is. You see, we don't accept that. First of all, this particular terminology of total drug resistance is not at all an acceptable terminology even by the World Health Organization nor by RNTCP India. Mumbai, we have taken the fast action. All these cases are stable. They are responding. Of course, we do agree that it's a man-made problem. It is. These doctors are also responsible for creation of these kinds of drug resistances, you know.
But Dr. Nick West, a researcher at the University of Queensland and an expert in drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis, says untreatable TB is very real.
There's certainly drug resistance throughout. I mean, globally, 5% of all the new cases of tuberculosis are multiple drug resistant. So these are strains which are resistant to more than one. In fact, they're resistant to generally two of the frontline antibiotics which are used to treat them. And this is 5% of all new cases. There's a lot. It gets worse than that too with the extensively drug-resistant TB, so which are resistant to not only the frontline antibiotics but second line as well, plus some more sophisticated antibiotics. They're resistant to these. And these have been reported in 68 countries at the moment. And what that has happened in India earlier in this year, there was a report of 12 cases of totally resistant tuberculosis, so that is that it's untreatable.
India does have an extensive treatment program for TB, and Dr. Kumar is confident that the country's diagnostic centres, totalling over 11,000, will rise to the challenge.
All of us in the TB, they are working like a team, you know. It's a global team which is working with a very serious concern, and India is leading, let me tell you. India is the country which has demonstrated a lead role in not only drug resistance, but the entire TB control in the world.
Some experts say that delays in proper treatment may lead to the emergence of more virulent strains of TB.
I think that the danger of totally resistant TB becoming a dangerous global issue is probably of there's a lower risk of that. I don't think there's much chance with when we have very good containment and monitoring systems in most industrialised countries. However, the spread of it will, I'm sure, will happen. It's very easy to contract. It's very easy to pick up. The problem is obviously in the treatment. So people with TB are contagious when they are sick. So that is at a point when they need the treatment. Now, if they can't, if their treatment is ineffective, then they're just going to be spreading that.
And with that report from Annabel Boyer, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Once again, if you have any story ideas or suggestions for the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us anytime via our email, pcj@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcj@pcjmedia.com. Special thank you goes to Radio Australia for the material used on today's program. So on behalf of them and everyone else that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well, hoping that you join us again very soon for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. So long, everyone.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet. This is PCJ Radio.